Yo, welcome everybody, and welcome to Philosophy Friday! Actually, we're recording on a Monday, but anyway, today we are going to be talking about how do game companies predict game success. Now, Brett and I spoke about product validation before on a previous episode, so make sure to check that out, but this topic is very deep, so we brought on Mr. Adam Telfer, who also has a number of thoughts and relevant experience in this area to speak further on this topic. And even further, we did not talk about corporate structure that typically surrounds this process around product validations for games and how greenlighting, and especially at the bigger corporate companies, how greenlighting is done at many game studios. So we will also dive into that topic as well. But anyway, before we jump in, welcome guys. We've got our regular host, Brett Novak, CEO of Liquid and Grit, the best mobile free-to-play market research company out there in the world. Our guest, Adam Telfer. Adam, you've been on here with us before, but just to set the stage for folks who may not be aware of why you actually can bring a lot of deep insights and relevant experience about these topics, can you give the audience a brief intro on your background or about what you're currently doing?
Sure. So I guess a bit about me. I'm a indie game programmer that kind of fell backwards into product management that somehow now runs central product management at WB. So on this topic in particular, right, like when we're talking about 0 to 1, early product validation, new game development, this topic is very near and dear to my heart because I've just been doing it for decades. And I think it's just one of the most like nebulous, subjective parts of development that a ton of people still get really, really wrong. It is still very much art, not as much science as you can see from live development, but still an incredibly important topic. And I've really been trying to add some objectivity to it, or at least some frames of how to do this correctly in both, say, on the game side, the studio side as a game lead, and as well as part of, say, a central corporate publishing unit. So I've spent a lot of mindshare on new game development for the last, more than a decade, and even ended up talking at GDC about it back in, I think, 2015. And I still feel like I've really only scratched the surface. And I think if you watch that GDC talk, I got a lot of things wrong. So I appreciate coming on today and having a debate about this, just because I think it's such a deep topic. A lot of people get it wrong. And I also appreciate being able to get gut checked on a few of my assumptions. That's it.
All right. Well, let's just get it started, guys. And maybe we can start with this open question about how do you predict product market fit for a game at the concept stage? And I don't know if one of you guys want to jump in or I can get this started. Here, I'll just get it started. So I will get this started by poking fun at big game companies, such as companies that
may not be named. Yeah.
So I think predicting product market fit at those companies is especially complicated. And it's tricky because it's both art and to some degree science of sorts. And corporate execs, I think, really just aren't good at art, especially like the business school, McKinsey, blah, 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 blah. And so they often fall back on proxies with many times flawed assumptions. But I would say in my experience, one big problem with most bigger game studios is that there is like a green light process starting at concept in which some senior exec makes a call on what game should be greenlit. Now that exec often has never made a game before, like never. Maybe they have published, meaning they've financed a game, but it's really oriented around like the opinion of some old guy who went to business school or worked in consulting, or something like that. And so like, but you're not getting a decision made by potentially the right person. So, you have these studios or internal folks coming with a bunch of pitches and pitching that key exec or group of execs, and they dictate what moves forward or not. Therefore, for a lot of companies, predicting product market fit means the gut feel of some old guy who's never made anything before and really doesn't understand current culture or themes or trends, but rather spends most of their time reading summaries and research reports that they've probably spent like, you know, $200,000-$300,000 on. And so based upon their gut feel on reading these summaries and, yeah, my son Billy told me this, that's how the green light kind of happens. Now, I mean, I think it's often better at startups because you may have, not always, but at times, people who have actually made games before, who have deeply studied a genre or sense some potential opportunity based upon some intuition that they have from deep experience. And I would say like one example is Dream Games, a team with world-class depth in a category. Like they knew that category cold, in addition to all of the complications, the production process associated with building top-grossing games in that category. And so, you know, predicting product market fit for them in that genre through their deep insight, through their experience and extreme depth of the genre is generally going to be, I think, a better predictor of success. But just kind of speaking more generally, I think the other popular ways to predict product market fit at Concept is basically through kind of internal validation by a tastemaker. This means the intuition and insight by a person who has appropriate background, depth, expertise, insights, or secondly, external validation, meaning player feedback. There are teams out there who basically, you know, through Discord channels and things like that, keep close to key influencers, tastemakers, experts in the games they are entering and share and get feedback from those influencers. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think proving product market fit in the beginning isn't necessarily the task, right? From the start, it becomes, I think, more like that book, Thinking in Bets, right? That you're playing a round of poker. You're trying to establish, you know, are we setting up the right baseline for this game, this concept? And you're trying to de-risk things as you go through. I think I'm talking about the ideal here, not necessarily talking about all the corporate shenanigans that will go into it. So when you're thinking about product market fit right from stage one, right from the concept, I'm actually much more focused on what is the team, right? And do they actually have their head screwed on straight about the genre and the lane that they're going down into, right? That's usually a much stronger signal than necessarily looking at the game itself and saying, hey, does this have a perfect fit towards the market? It starts off with that elevator pitch, that sentence, that hypothesis, that strategy of, hey, we think if we attack this genre like this, go after these players like this, that we can open up the market in a new and interesting way. And then really asking that team, you know, have they built games like this before? Where does their background come from? Where do they come from in terms of have they been able to execute on this before? And asking them about games like the competition, right? Like what is broken about the games in this genre that you want to see fixed with this game? And is that the way that they define that in terms of what's broken about the genre done in a nuanced way? And I think the biggest red flags that I've seen from pitches is when they look at the top incumbent game and they point at very surface level issues of things like tutorials, things like simplifying the economy to kind of address a wider market, instead of actually playing that game to a very, very deep level and understanding how to operate that game when live, and then saying, here's our competitive advantage by adjusting systems like this, adjusting mechanics like this, we'll be able to deliver value to players at a faster cadence than any of our competitors. That's usually what I see as good product market fit. Does that make some sense?
Yeah. I mean, I like the point where you're focusing on people. And I think that's where some execs can kind of like, you know, that's an area where you can say you've had past success or things of that nature. And so you don't necessarily need to understand concepts so much. And I definitely agree, like people trump concepts. But at the same time, I also think that some of the bigger companies are kind of at a disadvantage by not being able to, you know, like different points in the funnel. If you can optimize each point in the funnel, you may not be optimizing the concept stage because that exec just doesn't know, but, and maybe they're just going purely off of team, but I think it is like a multi-layer puzzle where if you can kind of optimize more things, you're increasingly de-risking the potential outcome of the product.
Absolutely.
But yeah. I would definitely agree with you that, you know, people definitely more important.
Yeah. Brett?
Yeah, I second that about people. I mean, I like the people aspect. I think one thing that gaming companies probably don't do enough of is allow that team to work together prior to when they're going to build this new hit. I mean, if you look at a lot of successful gaming companies, they had a bunch of games they produced first before that game that was ultimately the key success of the company. And I think that potentially either you have, you select a team that's worked together and been proven to have that chemistry, or you select a team, a new team, and you allow them to do some development for a few months to just build that chemistry because that's so important. The second part is if you have that great team, I think what JK is alluding to is you have to give them the autonomy to actually work and have independence and create this innovative new idea. And what I think you're alluding to, JK, is when you have that design by committee organizational structure, right? Where they may have an idea, but then they go talk to the execs or they go talk to the other whomever, you know, stakeholders. And all of a sudden, those people want to add this, add that, and add this other thing. And then all of a sudden, you have this you know, design by committee game, which is obviously not good. The third part that I'll add is a little bit of the NBA bend on this, is I do think that there is a conversation maybe before this about aligning the strategy of the company with the concept, right? And more specifically, how innovative, how risky do you want that game to be? And how does it fit into the larger sort of story of the company, right? I mean, you can make games that are the second version of a game that you already have, right? That's obviously a much safer bet than going off and saying, we're going to go build the newest genre, right? Like we're going to go create a new genre, a new category, or we're going to go on a new platform or whatever it may be. Right. And I think that without having that conversation, tensions are created later on when you have an exec who's answering to a public market or whoever they're answering to. And then you have a game team going off on in their own direction. Right. So I think that's kind of an important part of this story. That's to figure things out before you go off and say, okay, we want to go create this game, right? It's kind of aligning teams.
Yeah, and maybe like as you were talking, Brett, one thing I thought about was that another problem that I've seen at times on some pretty big budget games is the specific way you execute against a game design. And so kind of like, you know, and just again to throw some shade on the MBAs out there, but... What I've
seen have an MBA, like, just JK, just so you know.
I went to Dartmouth. But and Adam's got the book, a lot of people told me when you talked about it, a lot of people bought it. So you, yeah. You're very
hopefully
influential. But one thing that I have seen in a specific studio and other studios is that when you have someone leading a game studio that does come from that background, Microsoft or whatever, and then a game is being designed where they're like, okay, we don't kind of know how to design the best features, so we're going to hire these consultants to go out and ask the players, what do they want? And then they just throw all this crap in, and it's just like a hodgepodge of crap because there is no holistic vision. There's no kind of through line in terms of like what the game should kind of how it should play and who it's catering to. Instead, it's just this mishmash of this player said this, this focus group said why, this focus group said whatever. And so you get this huge, you know, Frankenstein monster that happens. And so Oh, go ahead.
Have you ever had good experience with consumer insights driving design on a game? So
I have.
Have you?
Yeah, and I do think there are.
Yeah.
Oh,
no. I just love to hear that example, just because I've heard. I from my experience, I've had such bad experiences with driving consumer insights, action yes. impact design, that I'd love to hear good stories for that.
Yeah. Well, so let me start with the. So I agree with you. The majority of research is pretty flawed, and often has to do with this point that I'm harping on, which is execution, right? But there's, for example, there's this research firm that puts surveys on offer walls, right? And then they'll ask all these really important, critical questions about the, like, about a new game design or something like that in this offer wall. And what you see are people that just, like, fill out, you know, they accept the offer and they're just like, tap, 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 tap. Okay, give me my 30 gems, right? And it's like, our research shows that, you know, it's just garbage, right? So that's one bad example. I would say, I mean, like,
good researchers should be able to remove that data.
But. Definitely. So, yeah. So, you know, the person counts, right? Like the execution counts. Now, I would say, like, I do think we have gotten good research done, both qualitatively from, you know, hosting pretty in-depth focus groups. And again, your mileage may vary, the quality and how you structure it is very important. So it really does depend on the kind of questions that you ask, how you structure the focus group and things like that. And some of the concept testing that I've done in the past really did highlight potential opportunities or areas where some concepts actually, you know, in hindsight, when you see the research, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then you kind of question, why did that perform better than another? And then, you know, you kind of dig into the forums, you talk to people, and then you like, ah, yeah, now I understand. So again, mixed bag. I agree with you. A lot of it's garbage, but I do think that it can be done situationally in a way that adds value.
Sorry, because
Adam, you should check out the podcast with Eddie LeBreton from Zynga Poker. He had a really probably the most successful story I've heard on consumer insights. Mm. I mean, it was for features though, and so I think that's the caveat. I think it works well for somewhat in a known entity space, right? Known entity space. I'm just making that expression up, but it's sort of like, okay, we have a game or we have a concept, we know it works. How can we tweak this? How can we improve this? Right. I think that's where consumer insights becomes the most valuable, because the players have an understanding of the concept. Whereas we're kind of talking about the what JK likes to say, the 0-1 concept, where I think consumer insights becomes less valuable, right? Because you're trying to explain this new concept, difficult concept to them, they're not going to get it, right? So it's hard to get insights from them because they can't comprehend the game, right?
Exactly.
So yeah, but that was pretty eye-opening for me. I agree. I mean, it was really impressive. I mean, they basically designed their whole roadmap based on this insight, and it was correct, spot on. But they could use their own players, right? So they got great users. And it was a known entity, and it was kind of tweaking an existing product, right? So a little bit different than what we're talking about.
Yeah. So I guess the caveat that I would have from the consumer insights, I really agree with you, Brett, for that 0-1 phase, because what I've seen a lot of, and I think this is a symptom of what Joe, you mentioned around executives and just like how they make those decisions, right? Is when they don't have the expertise in the genre, they don't understand the audience. They'll start relying more on CI and data to kind of justify decisions, right? So like, show me the survey that says your game will beat Fortnite, right? And so then you get this
CYA,
right? And then you get this like self-selecting survey thing of, oh, this person chose my concept over Fortnite, and thus we will make $5 billion a year, right? That's, or even just, of course, that's just the throwaway concept of there, but like still, like they'll try to use consumer insights to either justify or adjust things like forecasts or predicting success. And I don't know if you can really do that, especially when consumer insights that I've seen constantly fall down when you actually put them up to scrutiny, right? Because a lot of biases. I compare that to user research, right? Like actually user testing the game in front of players when you're further along in production, right? When you can really see their actual reactions to things. far more insightful. But of course, that's not going to be possible during the concept phase. Focus groups, like coming and pulling in the right players. So if you're building, you know, a game in a genre, let's say collectible RPGs on mobile, right? You're pulling in big spenders who love and spend hundreds of hours in these games, and you're asking them deep questions about what do they like and what they don't like about certain game concepts. I think that can be enlightening, and that can drive that strong vision from the beginning of your product. And especially when you don't have the experience as a game team, that's a very powerful tool. But then showing, say, a number, right? Like surveying 2,000s of people and saying, you know, of all the people that play AFK Arena, right, they love this IP, or they love this other, this statement within our consumer insights. You can't use that to kind of like justify or adjust a forecast. I think that your number is way too nebulous. And especially when you're looking at results from these consumer insights, where there is this baseline of people just tapping through, it becomes very easy to fall down under scrutiny when you start comparing it to actual market data, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the execution, and I actually, Brett, you brought up a good point. I do think like the situational context, like if people have a really great understanding of the gameplay, you're trying to fast follow and you have a survey, hey, should we do this game with Pokemon or Harry Potter or Star Wars or this or that, that's easier for a player to understand. They know the gameplay, they kind of understand what they're getting into. That's probably going to be a better predictor than, you know, if you have some brand new gameplay where it really would be more of a playable that actually informs them better. So I definitely agree with you guys on that stuff.
Yeah.
So
I will just kind of say,
I'll counter this with something that we've already talked about, and so I won't go into detail. Okay. But the naming story, JK, that you fell into the trap, right? Like, which is that Everyone thinks their idea, their name of their child is going to be super innovative, and then their child shows up at kindergarten, and there's like five of them with the same name. So whatever it may be, you do have to be careful about going with your gut instinct, because your gut instinct, or you know, this magical thought process, is the combination generally of a lot of influences that a lot of other people have. So even though it might be innovative, you might release it, and then a week later, three other games very similar might be released at the same time. So I mean, whatever the research is, we discuss this, but I think
I'm seeing that right now. There are so many people working on top-down cheaters right now. but maybe that is a thing, right? Look at all of the, you know, I'll mention this. Well, yeah, I mean, like all of the Tarkov extraction shooter-based games that NetEase and Tencent, I think there's at least 11 titles coming out between the two of them. Definitely. I think there are trends and things happening in the world that people just intuit. The people who are close, I'm not saying the execs, but the people who are close to these games, they feel something is coming, and they act on those trends.
The one example was at one point in San Francisco, there was like three parking dual-sided market companies like surfaced at the exact same time. It was like suddenly you could just like press an app and someone would park your car. Yeah. It was like three of them all of a sudden in San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
Like all three of them probably thought they had like the super innovative idea, and then all of a sudden there was like three of them competing vigorously for all of our attention. Yeah. Anyways.
But when it comes to like product validation as you go through concept, as you go through production, what I really want to push is, like, as we discussed in the beginning, 80% of the game's success is going to be based on execution, is going to be based on the people on that team actually knowing what they're building, actually having an experience with that audience, the overall intuition. And I would wrap that up in what Joe said before, where the intuition of that game is going to be based on everybody who's in the decision-making table for that, right? So making sure that when you're doing these green lights, the ability for that game to keep their head screwed on straight is very much dependent on who's on the green light committee. Do they actually fundamentally understand what they're building, who the audience is, what are the right features for these things? And that was what drives 80% of it, right? We can talk about this extra 20% of additional tools you can kind of use to help kind of break people out of that, say, horse blinder mode, right? When they're getting into like company and groupthink, where you can bring in consultants, you can use consumer insights, you can use user research, you can use, you know, like fake app store tests and these types of things. But fundamentally none of that is going to be a replacement for intuition on the genre that you're working in. And I think that's really, that's been my big takeaway over, you know, trying to use that 20% to help, you know, justify larger purposes or projects over the last 10 years, is that that system has so many caveats with it. It can never be larger than really 20% of your success.
Yeah. Well, I might push back a little bit in the sense that I agree with you generally, but I think there are times when that 80% could be lower, or that 20% could be a little higher. So for example, when people saw Battle Royale, like a lot of the early game companies that did Battle Royale were pretty successful. I kind of situational, the early guys who did MOBA first were successful. And then after that, nobody was successful. So I think there's like a time and a place and a situational context, but
with that Battle Royale trend, there was the intuition of the company that said, this is going to be a big thing. And that 80% became larger? Or are you saying that actually they looked at data, they looked at like consumer insights, and that 20%?
Like a lot of people who picked up on Battle Royale early and launched early, Green or Free Fire was like some random Singaporean based company, for example. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to Garena, there was, you know, PUBG and all the other guys that did all the Knives Out and all those like early guys. Not all of them were super successful, but at least most of the early guys were largely successful, profitable, things like that. And then, you know, more clear winners emerged over time, for example. Just to be clear,
I'm just asking, is that an example of those companies using tools like consumer insights and data-driven, looks at the market to infer what their next project should be? Or is that more on the side of intuition, that Garena, that Brendan Green used his intuition to say, this is going to be big, ignored all of that 20% and then built the thing? That's what I'm trying to get the stake. Are you saying?
More like if we're saying 80% is execution, 20% is concept. I think in that case, yeah, you needed good execution, and those companies that won early did have good execution. But, you know, it's probably maybe not 80%, maybe it's 50-50 or, you know, or something lower. That's all I'm saying.
So how I'm defining those two buckets is slightly different. So the 80% is your company's intuition, right? And in that case, it's like looking at, say, Extraction Shooter or Battle Royale, that company, when they decided that new game concept, went based on, I've been playing these games, this is the new shit, we are going in that direction, versus using data-driven, right? So it's like that, the execution side, I'm still aligned that execution will trump your concept. But to drive that initial concept strategy, how much of that is based on the intuition of your company versus data-driven tools like consumer insights, these type of things? Does that make sense?
I think I have my answer for it, Adam. Obviously doesn't, but my thought process is that the higher the beta, you know, the bigger the expected ROI that you want to have with that, will also have the higher risk, right? So if you want to have, let's say, the next top grossing mobile game in the world, right? Let's just for example sakes, you should go with the most highest beta idea, which is probably a single or two people intuition, right? And because the only way you're going to come up with this idea is it's going to be very contrarian, right? It's going to be some idea that a ton of the people in the room are going to go, that is a terrible idea. That's crazy. What are you talking about? Right? Because that's where real innovation is born, right? All these ideas that have change the world are generally ideas that tons and tons of people are saying that's crazy, that's terrible, right? So if your goal is that, then figure out a system that you're going to go with the intuition of the one or two people, or maybe it's three, but it's very small number that you're going to rely on to have this idea, and you're just going to green light it, right? Now, again, going back to the strategy, if you're a company that wants to have a closer bet to hitting a revenue target, to bumping your quarterly revenue by 2-3% or whatever it may be, then that's where you want to bring in more and more data, because consensus data, whether it be through research or through a larger team or like all the execs is going to bring you closer to a what would be considered a normal distribution of an idea, right? Meaning like if you think of like an innovative idea as a normal distribution curve, once you start adding all these data points, it's just going to become this idea that everyone can have, right? Which is only going to be marginally more innovative than anyone else's idea. So if you just pick that one person, that's so again, I mean, it kind of depends, but if I'm trying to make the next big hit, it's one or two people, I let them go and I say, whatever you guys think of, we're going to back. Right, we're gonna go with it. We're not gonna, you know. And then once they get through that initial stage, of course, then I think you get play testing and you get all that stuff involved, right? But the initial like idea, one, two people.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, Brett, is very similar to the Peter Thiel concept in Zero to One about startups. The biggest startups or the most successful ones have a secret, right? So what goes against consensus, but they know this secret that most other people don't know. And so by executing against that, that's why when, you know, if you were to say pre-Uber, hey, I'm going to start this business where you just jump into a car with a stranger that you don't know at all, and they're going to take you around, or even eBay, right? You're going to trust that they're going to send you the right shit and things like that. So that's the secret that enables them to have such a outsized outcome, but definitely agree with that.
And that's why only really startups, for the most part, can be innovative, right? Because in large organizations, you just have such a structure of consensus, right? Yeah. They're just like built on consensus. And it's not because larger companies aren't filled with innovative people or smart people or whatever. It's just organizationally, they're so predicated on consensus that all that innovation gets whittled away by the time that product goes live, right? Right. And so that's why startups are just organizationally a better system for creating innovative things. And so if you're going to do it in a larger company, you have to emulate a startup environment. And you have to say, here's $1 million, go away from us, go everything, detach everything from our organization, right?
I've just like seen you're going to make
on $1 million.
Yeah, not a lot anymore.
Well, I'm just saying initial seed fund,
but also like
you raise the initial seed, right? I mean, obviously, you know, but you run it like a startup. You say initial seed is $1 million,
right?
Come back to us with five, come back to us, propose five, come back to us for 20, right? And that's where you start with. You don't, you know, as opposed to what they do now, which is you're part of this massive entity and you have to go to all the all hands meetings and all the one-on-ones and all the management and all the other BS that goes on in a big company, and somehow you have to be super innovative, and you somehow have to have consensus, and you somehow have to have all the execs on board, and you somehow, like, it's like no, like, you're a startup, go, it's proven, that's the way to do it. Now, you know, then we can get into like how successful that's going to work. I mean, I think it's like a 1 in 10, a 1 in, you know, whatever number that may be, 1 in 15.
I'd just say with that startup structure, like, I've been a part of that type of thing in the past, and corporates or companies are not very good at killing games just in general. So like, I've been a part of companies that really took that impetus and was like, okay, we are going to be a startup. We're going to try to fund a whole bunch of things, and like, they'll get to that green light. But then you end up with a whole bunch of isolated green lights, right? So it's not like you get a bunch of really good concepts all coming at the same time. You're like, which one am I going to pick? It's like, this one came, and this one came, and this one came. And many times people are then in the green lights making emotional decisions, or decisions more based on retaining talent than it is about product market fit or right, like general success criteria, right? And it becomes really, really hard to stop that rolling stone as it goes through. So even though, like, from the pitch deck, I would absolutely agree, like, let's go towards more of a VC startup driven culture where we're like thinking in bets and we're trying to lower the risk as we go through production. Absolutely in line with that. It's just every time I've seen that in actual execution at companies, I've seen that ball just keeps rolling. There is no stop.
Yeah. I think the higher level perspective that we're talking about, and this is the mistake that a lot of big companies make, is actually understanding new game 0 to 1 versus 1 to N. And so 0 to 1, certainly like having a secret, focusing more on intuition and having the right structure for those kinds of teams working in 0-to-1 is definitely much more important. I think that to the point, though, of trying to have a big company emulate startup environment, it is difficult because in a startup, like when a startup is faced with really existential crisis, right? Like everyone's going to lose their jobs. Like in some cases, there are founders that have financed a large part of the game just on their credit cards, refinancing their house. And that drive, because you're backed up against a fucking wall and it's do or die, that's hard to say for an internal studio. What are you going to say? If you don't make it, you are all fired. Sometimes, but rarely, that kind of pressure, though, right?
HR is not going to agree with that one.
You know, right. And like, are you going to like say, okay, and by the way, you know, we're going to reduce your salary by 75%. So you really feel the pressure to make this thing successful. Like how many people are going to sign up for that? You know? So like, I definitely do think that, again, that it seems like the higher level thing we're talking about here is like the right environment, the right way to do 0-to-1 in a big corporate structure is difficult.
But I think coming back to your initial point.
I mean, all great things are difficult. Yeah, all great things are obviously difficult. But yeah. Adam, I completely agree, right? I kind of expression there's spreadsheets and there are people, right? Spreadsheets are generally much easier, right? It's like, here's the funnel, and I generally start out with the spreadsheet idea, right? Which is like what we're kind of talking about with the VC model. Right, which it sounds like we're all agreeing on. The second part is the people, and I think one thing that businesses don't do enough of, it's like you have HR, but you have you should have like human bias, like a human bias group that basically works to remove human bias from the process. I mean, I'll just give you an example. Like, I don't talk to a lot of people in my company, right? And people say, well, that's because you don't like people. That is not the case. I like people. I like lots of people. I'm very social. It's because the more I get to know somebody, the more likely my decisions about that person will be driven by bias. Oh, they have, you know, Adam's a nice guy. Adam's got a family. Adam's blah, 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 whatever. I'm not basing my decision anymore on Adam, the person, the whatever it is, right? The game developer, the producer, the designer, whatever it is, right? And so you're right. It's like all these biases. So I think that you would ideally create a separate group that's making decision on the greenlight process that has no basically connection to that group in any way. Like they're completely removed from it, and then have as much as they can, an unbiased approach to whether or not that game should be continued to be invested in or not, right? It's almost like an internal VC team, and they just have to be kind of ruthless about stuff. But you're right. In my experience, Adam, that isn't the case, right? I'm just talking about ideal. If I ran a giant public company, what I would do, you don't have that, right? You have people who have liked these people. They maybe backed the idea originally, or they're invested in it, or they've been telling the market about it or whatever. So you see all these biases happen. And I agree, these green lights just keep getting rolled out and rolled out and rolled out. I mean, sunk cost fallacy, right?
That would be extremely difficult. I don't think I would want to work in an environment where decisions on a game that I've been working on for years were done in a black box across and based on factors that I wasn't fully transparent on, or was so transparent and so objective that I'm like, well, you're not actually looking what I'm building, right? Like the decision-making criteria when you make that so impersonal becomes very difficult, right? Like you're not working on a match three game, thus kill, right? Or what would that actually be? Sorry, go ahead, Joe.
Well, we're skipping ahead to what I was thinking of one of the best examples, which was from New Toy. And they would have stages where you had to basically, they had criteria of how a game would get to the next stage. And they had a committee that basically allowed that, you know, that green light it and say, okay, you know, the first initial stage, these are the criteria. If you hit it, then you go to the next stage, you get more investment. The next stage, you have this criteria, and then the committee judges based on that criteria. And they didn't kill the game. What they did was they would like move you back or keep you locked in that stage. And then it was up to you whether you wanted to continue or not. And so it was a little bit of a hybrid. It wasn't as cold as sort of the idea that you were saying, where you're just killing it. You're just sort of saying like, hey, you haven't passed the stage of it's fun with one hand, or it's fun with a friend, right? So they built Words with Friends. So they had a very sort of like systematic way of thinking about games that they were trying to develop And the first was sort of like, it's going to work on mobile, right? So they could design that. And then, okay, great. And then they get to the next stage. We're going to give you a little more investment. It's fun with two people, right? And they got to prototyping very quickly. That's another
thing. And it's still like fun. Fun is impossible to measure, right? you're not just asking like 10 people, like, do you give a 4 out of 5?
Well, by the time they got to the like third stage, it was playable internally. So, I mean, they could kind of see where people going home and playing it, right? Yeah. I mean,
so that's the objective is like they're measuring, that, right? It's that like, would, are people
Yeah, I mean, once they got well to the fourth stage, they were, well, I mean, yeah, because, I mean, they had 20 games in development at any given time. They had Fridays dedicated just to game development, right? So the first, so Monday through Thursday was regular work. Friday was basically anyone can build a game. They had 20 games in process at any given time. And they were in different stages of this process. And then sort of the founders were the ones that were the judges. So, I mean, obviously they were maybe a little bit biased, but they were getting pushed forward and back. But yeah, by the time they got to like the fourth, fifth stage, it was a playable on your device, you know, test flight experience. It was rudimentary, but they could kind of see like, okay, am I going home and playing this game? Is everyone, you know, how many people in our company are actually playing this other than when we've asked them to test it, right? And so interestingly, what we, I think, came to, which is like that initial phase is super hard to predict, right? Like we all agree on that. So it's like what they did, and I guess it's obviously easier with the form factor and the game process that they were trying to develop, which was super simple, is they like tried to get out of that stage as quickly as possible. But I generally feel like that's a good process for any gaming company, right? It's like get out of that like theoretical stage as quickly as possible so you can play test something, because that's when you can get really good data about stuff.
Okay, so let's talk about this. So you talked about New Toys' green light process. And so a lot of big game studios structure their product validation process in that way, with some form of green light process that may consist of stages or milestones associated with it. And so, Brett, you talked about New Toy. Adam, could you, for our audience, could you kind of describe generally, because I think generally most big companies have a relatively similar process. Can you talk about that?
So I can't talk about WBs. I can just talk about it in general sense, right? Like
it'll be similar, I'm pretty sure.
So, but every game company that I've worked for, consulted for, right? Concept phase, pre-production, production, post-production or soft launch phase, and then live, right? So concept phase, basically you're getting up to the point of having an initial prototype. You're kind of really figuring out what is your strategy for this game, right? So you're given a whole bunch of budget just to explore the market, to say, this is who we're going after. This is why this market is interesting for us. And here's, as you said before, here's our secret, right? Here's what we believe is the table stakes for the market. And here's what we believe we should be doing differently, which will address this like underlying need in this market, and we'll have an outsized success, right? That's the concept phase, getting to that point. And then pre-production phase. So now you've got that initial spark of fun. You've got that initial pitch. You're now preparing for production. By the end of it, you're saying, is this thing ready for production, right? Like, have you actually scaled all of your production systems, production through content delivery, and then sort of post-production, soft launch, so validating through KPIs, and then launch, so actually having KPIs. Yeah, that's pretty much everything, yeah, right? But in terms of decision-making points all the way
sounds
along.
Sounds very similar.
Right, like everything has the same one. So it just matters, like maybe some companies that have had split up concept and prototyping into two separate phases. Some define, have longer pre-production phases than production phases. But from my experience, even though you have the stage gate process, every single stage bleeds into each other. There really is no defined stage. Even when you look at the actual production, in production phase, there's still like, holy shit, we don't know what this game is yet, right? Well, there's still defining features. Yeah. And in pre-production phase, they're still trying to figure out what really their winning strategy is going to be for this, right? Things, even when you try to make sure you're still hitting deadlines, things tend to bleed into each other.
Yeah. So I definitely agree, like that overall framework is pretty much the general framework most companies use. And to your point, I think the key differences are probably who makes the decisions, you know, the decision model, specific decision points, which you mentioned. I think also the specific artifacts, like in a concept phase, what are you expected to deliver? And then basically kind of like the orientation of how you make those kinds of decisions. Like, you know, for example, famously wargaming is famous for using MPS as a like a final milestone gate. So if your MPS score is high, it goes. If it's low, then it doesn't go. So like the ways in which you make those decisions. But yeah, ultimately, most of the big game studios have some variation upon this overall high level framework. So maybe like the follow-up question I can ask here then is, given this green light process that exists at basically almost every big game studio, what are some of the big issues or problems that you've seen from these corporate green light processes? And Adam, I'm not sure how honest you can be here. But I'll leave the door open to you. And if not, I'll go ahead and start dropping bombs first.
I'll add to your bombs. you establish the carpet bomb first. Yeah.
Okay. And by the way, I throw shade in love, not hate, because I just want to throw out from my experience some of these problems so that maybe we can make the industry better. But I'll go ahead and start with, I think I mentioned one big problem, which is who's making the call. And oftentimes in these big companies, the wrong person, the Microsoft McKinsey exec making the call, wrong guy, wrong person. Don't have it be that person. And the second issue, which I think we kind of touched upon, is cover your ass, CYA. And so a lot of green light processes I've seen aren't really free from politics. It's not a clean process. And because of the culture, the way that the company is structured, so many times people then become afraid of data and AORs are unclear. So a lot of time is just wasted and data is manipulated to tell whatever narrative that key execs want to see rather than really like, hey, let's be transparent, open, and really face the reality here, right? And so that often, for whatever reason, the politics of big companies, things like that, that doesn't happen. And oftentimes, speaking of AORs, oftentimes in these kinds of organizations, AORs are actually intentionally unclear. And I believe that the reason for that is so that whoever the highest level exec is can scapegoat somebody. So when a game project goes wrong, that exec can say, oh, yeah, this project fucked up and it was because of Billy or Sally. It's their fault. And then that person gets axed. And so some of these higher execs just lose all their top lieutenants. It's like, when are these guys going to know it's actually that person? You know what I'm saying? I think the third problem I often see are basically just jacked up milestones. So not prioritizing key risks. So many milestones are kind of like either arbitrarily structured and the green light is basically established around those milestones. But really, every game should front load key risks. What is the biggest risk in working on that first rather than saying, this risk scares me. I'm so afraid. We're going to throw it at the end, right? And then you have increasing commitments. And then when that key risk comes and blows up in your face and it's like, we've invested so much. We can't show a loss. Let's just push it through. So I think I'm just going to be honest. I do think that some of the execs at these big companies are too political and kind of, you know, too cowardly to face the reality. So I think that's another huge mistake that I often see. And finally, I would say like another kind of CYA cover your ass issue is an overemphasis on justification. I know, Adam, you had talked about a lot of testing and things like that. And so this is where, you know, you have these old execs who don't know anything about games, but they want to cover their ass. They want to say they're responsible for making decisions, but they don't know. And I've been told this by many, many high-level execs at various studios. You can't predict the success of a game. And so what do they do? Well, they then spend a lot of money, time, resources on lots of market research so that they can tell some boss in the future, well, the market research said this was going to be successful. Don't blame me. It was a market research, not me. And so I think like these are some of the biggest problems that that I would mention. In addition to, I would say, just to bring back the previous discussion of how, like, at some organizations, like big companies, can you create that 0-to-1 environment? And I would say for me personally, I'm going to be honest, guys, there are so many discussions I would never have had with my co-founders unless I had to, because, you know, I see my bank balance going down. I'm like, oh shit, we're fucked. I have to have this hard conversation. Even though I love my co-founders, I got to have this conversation, and I don't want to do it, but I do because I have to, or we will die. What do you guys think?
A bit foreboding.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, dude. We are going to die, you know, startup. Yeah. I think if I talking it through, I think that's an overemphasis on, and this is a human bias, an overemphasis on the idea, right? Which Adam talked about at the beginning, which I think is a key point of this all, which is that, you know, we like to think that our ideas are 90%, you know, there's the famous study you ask about a classroom of MBAs, associated MBAs, if they're above average, most of the class is going to say they're above average, right? So it's a human bias for us to think that our ideas are correct, that we're better or we're going to be better at something than we really are. So I think that the biggest thing I would focus on is getting past that idea phase as quickly as possible with as little investment as possible. And so what we see is I have an idea. Okay, great. Go spend, like you said, $500,000 on research, go build a milestone, go build a ridiculous cost structure, go build a P&L of this idea. Okay. So go spend 5 months and then go convince everyone in this organization that's a great idea. Then the idea finally gets through. You've already invested so much in that you're kind of pot committed. You know, even if after 5 weeks of working on the idea, you've realized it's a terrible idea, you've just spent 6 months on it, right? And what Nutoy did, which is I think what I would really focus on, is get past that idea phase as quickly as possible. You have a great idea, Adam. Adam's a great developer. He has an idea for a game. Great. Go get it on paper. Go. Here's a designer. Get past that stage as quickly as possible. We're not going to talk about budget. We're not going to talk about any of these things. And try to get it as quickly as possible out of that stage into something material that we can get some more accurate data on. Then we can talk about like these lengthy 3-year roadmaps and all this other stuff. The second part is understanding that you're only going to be 5%, 10% success rate on these ideas. And that's a conversation that people aren't having up front. Like in my company, I mean, I own 100% of the company, but so I'm constantly testing my ideas, but it's kind of funny how many of them are wrong. And I think when you're a PM on a game studio that releases a lot of product, you learn the same thing. It's like the best PMs are baseball player stats, right? They're maybe 29% accurate or 30% accurate. It's a low accuracy rate. You only realize that if you've done a lot of reps. And if you haven't, then you're thinking, oh, I'm 90, I'm 80. And you build the system around that 90 and 80% confidence level. And that's where I think the system really falls down, is you got to go into this process with the understanding that you're talking about a 15, 10% success rate. With that in mind, you're still really good at it. What are you going to do to basically de-risk, de-cost, do a bunch of different things to make it so you can be successful with this low success rate up front, right? And there's a bunch of things we can talk about that you could do for that. But those are kind of like the two fundamental things that I see are wrong about this system that could be changed. Okay.
And so maybe just like, how much do you guys think you can actually predict? And does it change at the various stages?
So
obviously prediction goes up at later stages. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, like I think this kind of gets into what we discussed before, or what you discussed in the last pod. But yeah, prediction ability goes up over time, obviously. The weighting of how much, say, intuition-based it is in the beginning versus at the end decreases, right? So like in the beginning, the product success is all based on that company's core competency and intuition, right? Who's in that room, who's actually executing on that game. And then over time, you can use things like user research. You can use things like, of course, soft launches to give you a much stronger sense, right? But you're still not getting to 100%, right? With soft launch data, with good soft launch data, you're getting up to, you know, 80, 90% confidence intervals, but it's still not fully 100%, especially given the challenges of running an effective soft launch in this current market.
And like maybe then another question I can ask, and I do think it's situational. I know we had another discussion offline about, you know, can you predict a concept success? And I personally feel like in cases you can, like, you know, when I first saw Battle Royale, you know, King of the Kill, it was like, this is obvious. This is, you know, it was really amplified when I was on a plane and I heard like the whole trip, and it was like 4 hours, these kids just talking about it the whole way over. And then I checked it out and was like, oh shit, this is for real. And then when I saw Defense of the Ancients, it was so obvious. This concept, if done right, is gonna be successful. Now, I don't think that applies to every concept out there, but maybe there is some situational aspect to it as well. But maybe another question I can ask for you specifically, Adam, is that, okay, so to some degree, you can predict some stuff, you can test some stuff. So like in concept, based upon your experience, what you have done, and I know you don't put a lot of credence based upon your previous comments on consumer insights and research, but what would you test, let's say at the concept stage or later? What kinds of testing would you actually do?
It's a good question. I don't think I have a really good answer, right? Like I think I would do focus group testing. And I would use that to drive what the hypothesis is, right? I would use market data to pull up some math around, like, here's the audiences that we're going after. Here's how large this idea can be. But all of those things, each one of those pieces has to become with a lot of caveats, right? Like looking at historics means that you're blind to certain opportunities, right? Using focus groups means you're looking at a pretty small sample set, and you need to make sure that you're asking them the right questions to avoid groupthink and bias. But during that, like, really early concept phase, like validating a concept, I have not seen any success from, you know, like throw up a fake app store test, throw up a video, and you can prove that this concept is going to blow everything out of the water, right? Like many of the measurements that we in KPIs we'd see at that stage, then you add 2 years of production of game development or more in many cases, that doesn't happen, right? Like there's no way a video click-through test 2 years ago can validate that there's a market interest today. So I have not seen it, which is really what pushed me to this podcast was like, has anybody seen it? Has anybody really seen that test? Because the only ones I can see that are successful are hyper-casual, where they would, you know, build a game in a matter of days, throw that thing up, look at ad usage, look at D1 retention, look at CPI, instantly kill a game based on that. And that's a great model. And that works for hyper casual. I don't think it works for anybody else though. So I've yet to see it.
Okay. So maybe like, I think that's interesting. You know, and it's interesting to kind of compare, for example, the Chinese companies to Western companies, right? Because I think like one of the differences would be that it seems like the Chinese, you know, and I don't know, but my assumption is the Chinese believe that they can actually predict concepts, but they can't predict execution, right? And so that's why I think I mentioned earlier, NetEase, 5 or 6 different extraction shooter-based games with different teams. So they believe in the concept, they don't believe in the execution, so they're going to put multiple teams against it. They did that with WeChat. They had like 3 different teams work on that. And I would say like in Western companies, you generally see only one team against one concept. And I do think that that's like a big difference. But yeah, I do think that, go ahead.
So do you know what type of data that they're looking at during that concept phase? Like there's market data, which can suggest like when we're looking at extraction shooters, mm-hmm. right? There was already market data years ago that would suggest that Tarkov was overperforming relative to its scale, right?
I actually believe that based upon my experience with some Chinese executives, that the confidence they have in a concept comes from intuition of some key people who have kind of like risen through the ranks and have shown some success before. That's my belief.
Yeah. So and then I think that's kind of our unified point on this podcast, which is that during that very early concept phase, it is about the intuition of your company, and you need people that are actively playing these games and looking for, you know, what is the new interesting way of playing. And the only way you're going to do that is if you're actually playing these games, right? Like, you go play all of these collectible RPGs on mobile and you're like, this game, even though it's, you know, built by some indie team, super small, there's something really interesting going on here. Or if you're building shooters, you play Fortnite, you find some creative mode that all of a sudden is blowing up, but you feel it when you play it. Unfortunately, there's not going to be a lot of quant data that you can point to, and you should be waiting for, because by the time that that happens, then you're right into kindergartner naming conventions problem. If we can name that again.
I like that, Adam. I completely agree. I mean, I'm not, I'm in this weird position where I'm not no longer on the game side. We do obviously consulting work for large companies, but so I'll bring it to a little bit to my experience. But in a book of the founder of Toyota, I read one of his books, and he used to literally sit in a room and lay there and think all day. And this is a guy who invented the equivalent of sort of like the cotton gin that created basically like a way to make Spintress like super much more powerful. And then he sold that company. He was like, cars is the future. Didn't know anything about cars, like cars the future. Sold that and started Toyota. And it really struck me as like you said, Adam, it's like this deep thought process, this artistic process is what creates amazing things, right? I mean, if you think about paintings or music or things like that, right? It's this dedicated deep thought process over and over again. We're talking about writing. And I'm not the same in game development, but when I think about organizational design, that's something that I think about a lot. When people come and talk to me about it, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but I'm like, listen, I'm already thousands of hours deep in thinking about organizational design, right? Like, I've literally obsessed about this. I'm always thinking about this. I've been thinking about it on this podcast, right? Like, organizational design, company design is something I've obsessed over for years. I'm 7 years in. And so when you have that type of person, like you said, that person who's obsessed with the genre, obsessed with the games, and you really want to be betting on that person to think of like connecting different dots, new dots than anyone else, versus, oh, let's just get the average of a bunch of people who've thought about, you know, a research company org design, right, Adam? Like, let's get a million people and ask them how Brett should structure Liquid and Grit. That's not going to be... I actually had a debate with some finance guys a couple weeks ago. He's like, markets are great. I'm like, the average of a bunch of fools is not a genius, right? And so it, like, I completely agree. It's like, you want to have someone who's like obsessive about this industry, completely focused on it, knows so much about it, and bet on them being able to connect more dots. At the same time, you got to understand that even that genius is going to have a bunch of bad paintings. To your point, JK, you want to have like four of those people executing the process, right? It's like that. There's one point is the idea, the other is the execution. So I like that process you're talking about that the Chinese companies are doing, which is saying, okay, we're all like going in on this bet, but like the execution of it is going to be extremely hard. So let's have four teams or five teams try to execute on it. I think that's a great system.
Yeah, I think most publishers would wish they could do that.
Don't have the cash of Tencent.
There's no way, right?
But I guess the point is if they, yeah, but I guess the point is if they can't, then don't, right? Like, so they're making bets on like, well, we have $100 million to make a new game, and they're betting $95 million on it. You know what I mean? And it's like, okay, you need $1 billion, or you need to make a smaller game, right?
But then how many game companies have that much money? Versus what I think is healthy is you get that creative team together, right? They go after a strategy, a lane, a genre that they know deeply that they've executed on in the past. And that during that concept phase and prototype phase is their exploration. But eventually you're going to have to get to that communal stage. Like if we're going to find a compromise between Tencent, you know, putting multiple high-end studios against a single idea versus what most people are going to have to do as a smaller studio than Tencent, which is most of us, I'm assuming, right? Is you're going to have to figure out ways to pull up those key risks and give teams the creative space and incubation space to try out multiple ideas going after it. And then, but eventually it's going to have to be down to commit to one. And you're going to have to figure that out early on in the process. And then coming back to our initial point from this podcast is the people making that decision of which of those concepts is going to be best. The best thing you can do is concentrate that group with deep thinkers about the genre, right? You can't fill that up with people that don't have experience. And I think that comes back to core competency of companies, right? If you're a mid-core company, you shouldn't be making casual games. If you're a casual game company, you shouldn't be talking about mid-core games. But you know, that comes down to the intuition of your company. You got to build up that muscle to do that. You've got to play a shit ton of games.
Yeah. And one tactical thing that I think a lot of gaming companies don't do in this stage is like you said, like break out the game into a bunch of components, right? There's a new user experience. There's the core loop. There's the live op, whatever it is, right? Or, you know, whatever type of gamer, break it out into its components. Maybe there's 10 of them or something, and label them innovative, not innovative, right? Because, and again, that goes back to the strategy. It's like, okay, what part of this game are we really betting on? In most of these games, it's the core loop, right? It's the core experience. But that's not always the case. Maybe you're doing another shooter and it's the cosmetics or it's the battle pass or it's something else, right? But break them out and go non-innovative, moderately innovative, very innovative, right? Because what I see often is they don't do that. And then you have the game teams debating the new user experience. They're going to debate the colors. They're going to debate the icons and all these different things that don't matter, right? And they spend tons of time on that. And that's where those timelines get so stretched out, where it's like, listen, these five things we're going to copy. And Zynga was really good about that. I mean, Pinkus was really good about being like, hey, these four things just like copy. I mean, to, you know, potentially an extreme, right? But there's learning there. And then spend all your time on this one component that if we nail it, this game is going to be awesome. And that's where I think the market research goes into. That's where I think the testing goes into. That's where most of the focus goes into. But if you don't have that conversation up front, Adam, I mean, you know it. You've worked with like game teams and game designers. It's like every little component of it, they want to discuss all those, every little thing. And it's like, does this really matter? You know? So I think that's an important part of the process. I have multiple stories of that in the game development side that I can tell, that, you know, people debating what color something's going to be. Are you going to a scratcher? Are you going to scratch it or are you going to tap it? It's like, who cares? You know?
I mean, especially startups with limited budgets, knowing what to prioritize, what to focus on, and the other stuff, just got to let it go. Definitely agree on that. So we're over an hour, and I know, Adam, you got to jump soon. So maybe we can end it with this last question. We'll make it controversial, which is that there have been a number of recent and not so recent game launches, which in retrospect, or even ahead of launch, just seem obvious. What are you guys thinking? This game is doomed to fail. How can you, would you guys agree with that? Can you tell if a game is going to be successful or not early in the process or during development? And how can you avoid these type of situations? And just as some examples, and sorry, I know some people are going to get mad at me, but just to name a few examples, Star Wars Hunters from Zynga, sorry, Brett. Harry Potter, Wizards Unite, sorry, Adam. Anthem, Jump Force, and maybe a pretty huge non-games example would be something like Quibi. So what do you guys think? How could these things have been avoided, if at all?
So I think in all of those example cases, including the one that must not be named, I think if we went through the reasons that you had in your brain of why they failed, it would be there's an audience, there's a genre, here's the list of requirements in order to execute in that genre, right? Like to be a successful match three game, to be a successful collection RPG game, to be an exceptional premium game fighter. This is what you need to do. to be able to execute, and they didn't hit that list. And when you look at a video right before launch as an external person looking into that company, you say, hey, they are breaking that list. There's a few things on that list they are absolutely not executing on. I really wonder how they're going to do it. And that's really what we've done on like the Deconstructive Fun podcast. I would look at a video of a game coming out in like a few months, and I'd be like, ooh, looking at like reading a few lines deeper into that design, there's some issue there that they haven't really thought through, right? That's when you get into, yep, you can probably predict the success is like, this game is not executing on that list. And the only cases that breaks out is when you look at stuff like Brawl Stars, where I think industry executives, people you'd assume would be subject matter experts, all looked at that game and said, yep, this game is not ticking the boxes it should. But then Supercell stuck with it, fixed it, and got it out there. But I don't think right before launch you could have said that game would have been.
And to Supercell's credit, I think they put their trust in the game team instead of execs. And you know, they're one of the few companies pretty good at, you know, famously for killing game projects and not having consequences and having a safe environment for doing that. So good for those guys.
But I would say just the controversial answer to your question would be like, from the idea portion of that, right? Like there's something completely wrong with some of those concepts, but the execution side of that thing of like, here's your idea, here's what the requirements would be to actually hit that idea. Many of those things weren't hit. And I'm apologizing to everyone on that list, including.
I kind of agree with you. I think the execution could have saved, well, it'd be, besides Quibi, like execution could have probably saved.
I actually don't know what Quibi is.
Quibi was like short form mobile video, like kind of like YouTube, but paid. Yeah.
So dumb. TV thing.
Is
that already dead?
I think it is dead.
Is it already dead?
Anyway.
It's dead.
Man.
Really?
No, I don't play anything that's not a game. Sorry, man. Don't have time for TV things.
Yeah. Quibi content, Roku, personally. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
A lot of money.
Go ahead.
I'm going to add to this. I'm going to kind of answer it, which is to say, I think companies need to figure out a way that they can fail. Failure isn't as bad as people think it is. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's like failure is kind of necessary. I mean, I obviously don't promote failure, and you want to, I mean, sure, there's a lot of smart people in all those companies working hard to make that successful. My point is even the best people, the best game developers, whoever, are going to fail. So build a system or build things into the system that assume you are going to fail as opposed to assuming you're going to succeed. And I think that's where these things fall down. If you assume you're going to fail, then you don't bet 100% of it, 100% of your budget on a game. If you assume it's going to fail, you have all these safeguards in place to remove bias. If you assume you're going to fail, you know, and I think it's like just so frowned upon to fail. I mean, I think of ideas all the time and I try them and they fail. It's okay. You just got to do it fast and not investing like Bezos says. Like you don't want to be making that bet, the company bet on, then it's too late. So just figure out how you can fail and continue to fail. Like we're talking about Brawl Stars, right? I mean, that's a good example of it. They sort of fail the beginning and stuck with it.
This kind of actually reminds me of a conversation I had. I don't know if you guys know who Slim is. He was the guy who kind of led Valorant at Riot, and now he's working on a new startup called Raid Base. But you know, I asked him, you know, based on your experience, what does it take for a shooter game to be successful? And I think just looking at this list, whether it's Star Wars Hunters, Harry Potter, Anthem, Jump Force, you know, the thing he told me is it's actually all about love. And what he told me is that there are 1,000 decisions that go into making a game successful or not. It's not just a few decisions. There's thousands of these small decisions, and the team that loves their game, they have a passion for it, and they do what they need to do to make those decisions, right? They've got the love for the game. That's what actually drives these products to success. And so, I don't know, I thought that was pretty insightful personally. And, you know, yeah, he's a smart dude. I should get him on a podcast at some point in the future too.
It makes sense, right? Like, and what a great example too of like even Valorant, how they did things like bring in those pro streamers throughout thing. Like that's a good example of proper consumer insights. It's like you bring in the tastemakers, which is these influencers, you get them sitting in your game. And I remember hearing stories about how they validated it, where they intentionally try to get them to play for a longer period of time and rip through that bias period of them just being excited to be there, right? They really tried to push them for very objective, very critical feedback on their game to get them to the point that they knew this thing was going to be a hit, right? I think that's the hallmark of a good team, that they can really push towards critical feedback.
All right. Well, folks, there you have it. Predicting a game's success and corporate nonsense. Hopefully, Adam, we didn't get you in too much trouble.
That's gonna be the title, eh? Okay.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for all those who've watched this far, and we will catch you next time. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Brett. Thanks, Adam. Catch y'all later. Bye.